Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Ability to not be able to get an answer. And I think we're finding that out. And we turn on the TV or read the mass media, there are no answers. It's just doom and gloom. So today I wanted to have a colleague come on, a physician who's also a Christian and God-fearing. And we wanted to have a conversation about hope and about faith and about what we can do as individuals, not what we're told to do, but what we can do to bring ourselves closer to God and get our center and our peace back. So today we're joined by Dr. Casey Guthrie. He's a member of the Christian Medical Association and the American Academy of Psychiatry and the Law. He has a wealth of experience. He has done his internship in general psychiatry and forensic psychiatry fellowship at the Louisiana State University Health Science Center, LSU Health in Shreveport, Louisiana, where he served as a chief resident. He's board certified in both psychiatry and forensic psychiatry, and he's a diplomat of the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology. He's been in private practice since 2012 and maintains active medical licenses in multiple states. In addition to patient care and forensic consultations, he currently serves as clinical faculty for the Virginia College of Osteopathic Medicine, Emory and Henry College, and Lincoln Memorial University. He's educated medical students, interns, residents, and physician assistants, lecturing on topics in general and forensic psychiatry. He's also presented research on the topic of Miranda warning readability. In clinical practice, he specializes in caring for individuals with treatment-resistant psychosis and mood disorders, including those adjudicated not guilty by reason of insanity. So this is somebody who can speak to a lot of different aspects of our mental health. And Dr. Guthrie, I wanted to thank you so much for coming on today.
It's very good to be with you, Dr. George.
I'm very much looking forward to our conversation because I think there's a lot of armchair psychiatrists out there telling us you should live in a state of uncertainty and fear. And I want a professional to speak to that. So I guess the first question I have is, in your opinion, what's the importance of God and spirituality in this time of uncertainty?
So we've seen an unprecedented disruption and in many cases, complete elimination of many common areas of life. That includes church, work, school. Those are some of the most significant. And so these avenues that we have had that provide us such meaning and purpose have been restricted or limited or completely disrupted. And we know that religion has a significant impact on well-being, provides a sense of meaning and purpose. Some of the other positive aspects of religion and having a relationship with God, of exercising one's faith, include the ability to cope in adversity, positive emotions to really diminish the likelihood or the impact of depression or anxiety, and instill a sense of hope and optimism. In some cases, we've been limited and we've lost the ability to do that. From a Christian perspective, you know, we read the Bible and we're to give thanks in all things, to be content in all circumstances. And we're able to do that because we recognize that God has done the heavy lifting. So in good times, we praise the Lord. In hard times, we still praise the Lord because he sustains us and has done that heavy lifting for us.
I agree. And there's seems to be a bit of a political assault on religion and on a disruption of that relationship from a standard standpoint. You can never be removed from God, frankly, and you can have a personal relationship. But I'm speaking now about the churches and the fact that there seems to be a bit of hypocrisy. You can go and you can protest, you can riot, you can burn and loot, but you can't go to church because it's somehow going to increase the risk of COVID. And what's your take on that? Is this something that, as whether you're Christian, Muslim, whomever, right? If you have a relationship and you have a place that you can worship, do you think that there's and it's a provocative question, but is this a bigger picture where they're trying to really actively remove us from faith?
So whether it is an active attempt to inhibit faith or limit people's ability to exercise their faith and really fellowship together, I don't know if it's intentional or if it's just the inevitable result of some of the trends that have been happening in our society and in culture. I think when we, you know, we study anthropology, we study human history, I think that people are going to have a religion of sorts. So whether or not that it is a major recognized religion, religion still has to do with, at its core, how to function in the world, how to view the world, how to behave, how to view other people, and how to relieve suffering. So whether or not an individual adheres to one particular faith tradition, they're going to do those things one way or the other. So if they're not following a particular faith tradition, I think people are going to find something that really looks like a religion and serves those functions for them. So whether or not they, let's say they worship a celebrity, or a hobby, or a sports team, or the government, I think that what we're seeing is really a shift from this concept of a hierarchy of God, country, family, neighbor, and then self, really inverting that. And we see that playing out in politics and the world around us and the decisions that our leaders make. And then on, a more local level, just sort of, not just an ideological attack on faith, but even physical attacks on symbols of faith. So whether that's churches or statues, and that has happened in other countries in times of significant hardship, economic hardship. I'm thinking of places like Chile or Venezuela. It was a very similar progression to what we're seeing now.
We're going to take our first break, but I'd like to plant this seed before we go. You know, if people are worshiping secular things that shift, the cultural norms shift, how do you find stability? And does that really give you peace of mind? Because you're worshiping something that has no foundation to it. And I'll let you think about that. And let's answer that if we can, when we return, you're living in the solution.
Understanding health insurance is becoming more challenging. If you currently have insurance, you've probably noticed that it costs more to see your doctor. And if you're able to keep your doctor, it takes longer to get an appointment. The bad news is this trend is projected to continue. Your costs will continue to rise while your healthcare choice and access will fall. The good news is Peachtree ENT Center has the answer to this problem. We're committed to working with you. We specialize in providing affordable care for patients without insurance, those who are underinsured, and those with high deductible or catastrophic coverage. And we offer same-day appointments. You no longer have to choose between staying healthy and paying bills because Peachtree ENT Center is where patient care counts. Call 404-591-9100 or visit us at peachtreeentcenter.com. This is Dr. George. Living in the solution is not only about taking control of your health, it's about peace of mind. In uncertain times, your financial health is also important because it gives you options. I took control of my financial health by contacting Miles Franklin Investments, a company with 30 years of experience, an A+ Better Business Bureau rating, and over $600 billion in investments. They're also only one of 24 companies approved by the U.S. Mint. I recommend you find out if investing in gold or silver is right for your future. Contact Andy at milesfranklin.com and put Dr. George in the subject line for the best price guaranteed.
Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Guthrie. He's a member of the Christian Medical Association and the American Academy of Psychiatry and Law. And before the break, I asked a question that is kind of interesting to me, because we do have a society that worships people. It worships AI. It worships everything except a higher power, God. And you know, listening to some NBA player tell me how I should think doesn't give me peace of mind or comfort. So what is your opinion on that fact that we've moved away from something central to whatever wherever the wind blows, we're supposed to think of that as the thing we should follow and value?
Well, before the break, you framed the question, how does one find stability, if that's the case? And I would argue, and this is what I see in my practice, that people do not tend to find that stability. I think that this lack of meaning and purpose and the ability to find truth and morality outside of ourselves, whether or not, you know, some people do that through reason, some through revelation. I think in the West, we have a tradition of both. And if that is stripped away, if that is no longer adhered to, I think that when the storms of life come, it's going to be hard to stay afloat. And so that's something that I see happening with patients all the time. That's something I try to help them work through and to reorient to that truth and morality and purpose and meaning mm-hmm. in their lives. And I also think that we see this trend. We started to see it before the pandemic, where a rate of suicide, especially in adolescents, was increasing. And so life expectancy started to drop for the first time in many decades, and drug overdoses and suicides, especially in that adolescent population, were part of the reason for that. And during the pandemic, we're seeing an amplification of that signal in high school students, especially.
So the fact that kids have been taken out of the school setting where they can, if they have a catastrophic home situation that they can't escape, and being able to be with their peers, being able to actually interact, are you saying that that's one of the things that's making them so emotionally bereft? I mean, is that much power in that?
Right. I think that's part of it. I mean, I think it's not only schools, but a lot of the different venues that people had to just socialize as human beings, to be connected, to communicate, and do those things that are part of what makes us us. Just remember that, you know, we're in this together, and we're all having struggles when you begin to isolate people. And this is something that we see in the quarantine research literature in pandemics and disasters. When people can't do that, that's when we have an increased risk of that depression and that anxiety.
Well, from a I guess a pharmaceutical standpoint, I always have a question regarding the movement towards pharmaceuticals as the answer, and almost in some instances in place of communication and talking it out. It's a question that I'm just curious, especially with the youth. My mom was a teacher, and I remember back in when she was teaching, it was a big push towards putting children on Adderall and whatever. You couldn't have them come to school unless they were medicated. What's your take on that? Is that in any way a replacement for doing the hard work and actually investigating and exploring somebody's sense of self?
Well, I think it's becoming more and more of a Western phenomenon. It's very common here. I'm going to pause for just a second. I hear the overhead announcement, so it always distracts me. So I'm going to start over.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think that's becoming more and more of a phenomenon in the West, especially here in America. You know, one of the things that I teach my medical students when I'm teaching psychopharmacology is I try to impress upon them that every problem does not require a pill. And, you know, when the decision is made to use psychiatric medications, that is not the end-all, be-all of psychiatric treatment, nor should it be the beginning. So yes, I think, but I also think that what we're seeing with this push, that number one, we've medicalized a lot of the problems of living, that in previous generations were not considered the subject of for pharmacological intervention. But as we've had, you know, science has advanced and we've had more drugs discovered and come to market, we look for that shortcut. I think it relieves people's anxiety when they can frame things in terms of a disorder for which there is a pill, a problem with a ready solution. And you tell me what you think about this and what your experience has been. And I think that as physicians, we perhaps too often, either through the pressures of practice or training and this, you know, biological disposition, we begin to, you know, really oblige people to go that route. And taking psychiatric medications, on the one hand, it's very nice to see that the stigma of mental illness in some respects has been diminished and that people are more willing to access treatment when they need it. I've also seen the pendulum swing the other way, where there is an overemphasis or even a desire to be diagnosed and have the problems addressed with a medication, when more likely than not, learning how to think, using reason, interventions like cognitive behavioral therapy, or just good hygiene practices. That first paragraph that's in every medical textbook for every illness, we always study general interventions, and that relates to hygiene. So sleep and diet and exercise, taking time to teach patients to work on those elements and really focus and strengthen those aspects of treatment. That can be given short shrift, especially in places where, you know, healthcare is in an underserved area, those types of things.
I also wonder, too, if this movement towards medication is a victim of the healthcare system and how it's been set up over the past 15, 20 years about time and about reimbursement and the fact that physicians are not given enough time to see their patients. What's the average time is seven minutes for a general medical
Right.
consultation. I don't think the psychiatric consultations have been allowed to be as long as they used to be either, I would think, right? And so you have this get them in, get them out mentality, because you kind of have to if you have a private practice, unless you decide to go the opposite way with fee-for-service, direct patient care, you're on the hook. You have to have medical assistants, physician assistants, just the volume in order to keep your practice open. I don't think that serves any healthcare professional well. And we need to somehow grab that power back, I think.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with you. I was speaking to a colleague just today. We were talking about some of the major medical organizations and how well they do or do not represent us and the patients we care for. It's a challenge. It really is a challenge. So yeah, I kind of walk between the worlds, having a private practice, and you've got those quick 10-minute visits, whether or not it's in person or via telepsychiatry. And then I also spend some time volunteering in a local free clinic, where I just have the luxury of spending 30 minutes or 60 minutes or longer, with patients, just because I don't have those same pressures in that environment.
You must love that time too. It must be a gift.
Oh, it's great. Yeah, it's a lot of fun, because there I get to do therapy if I think a patient needs therapy, and, you know, judicious use of medications when that's appropriate, and teach them all those different things about good health and mental health hygiene. That's a lot of fun. It helps me keep things balanced.
Absolutely. And it's not a one size fits all relationship with your patient when you're able to do that. And it makes what we do fun. It actually makes us better clinicians. And for the patient, I think They have skin in the game. They have a relationship. And I think healthcare, no matter where, if you're a surgeon, psychiatrist, dermatologist, it doesn't matter. It's a doctor-patient relationship that's the power, and that's the time and the ability to listen. It's not ordering the test. It's not, you know, doing a procedure. It's that mental energy connection that you have with your patient when they realize there's someone who cares. And it's that, to me, is the kernel, the secret sauce, if you want to put it that way, that makes being a doctor really awesome. And I really would love to see us get rid of these middlemen and have that relationship back. And patients, frankly, have to want it. They can't just expect McDonald's level, you know, conveyor
right.
belt medicine.
Right.
So they're half the battle. We can meet them halfway, but they've got to have more. They have to want more for themselves.
Sure. Sure. Change is tough, but I think that's what's going to be necessary if we're going to get back to that idea that we're here to facilitate healing and relieve suffering and produce meaningful change in people's lives.
I agree with that, definitely. So now that we've gone into the COVID situation where there's a lot more virtual healthcare, do you think that that's, are there apps that you know about? Are there things that you've seen positives that patients are able to access more easily?
Sure. Well, I've been doing telepsychiatry for over a decade. When I was in residency training, we worked in the VA and we had the rural clinics, and we would beam in and see patients in those rural clinics. And we've just seen the expansion of telehealth across all specialties in medicine. And this crisis has really put it to the test and amplified the things that were beneficial, including improved access to care and allowing physicians maybe some better flexibility and being able to reach more people in a more efficient manner. And it's also demonstrated some of the things that were maybe not yet problems that weren't yet solved in telemedicine. But there's a number of companies out there, some of whom I've worked with. I think the major companies are like American Well, Teladoc, Doctors on Demand, Insight, that are providing psychiatry services, psychological counseling services, as far as the realm of mental health, in addition to all the other medical services that they provide.
Well, it sounds like if there's an array of choices, it has to be good for the patient who can't come in, who because of physical barriers cannot be face to face. Now it just means that you can, at your convenience, and maybe some people like that as well, they're more likely to do it because it is easy and because no one can see you and because you can just be in your comfort of your own home.
Right.
With talking to somebody.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. And people like not having to sit in a doctor's office in the waiting room too. That's usually a plus.
That's definitely a plus. On that note, let's take our second break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living a Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Guthrie. He is a psychiatrist. He trains residents. He sees patients. So this is somebody on the front line, not just talking, but actually doing the job of helping people. Now, you teach residents as well. And I'm curious to know what their mindset is. It's been a big difference when I trained and you trained, I'm sure, where it was just different. Now it's people want to go home. It's 9 to 5. They don't have a concept of necessarily always working hard. And I was wondering what the mindset is. Are the residents inclined to think outside the box like you are and have a spiritual component to their treatment of patients?
So I think the number of residents that still have that drive and that perspective on patient care, I think they're still there. I think it's at the same rate. But there's some generational differences that are going on with the current group of residents and medical students. One of the things I'm concerned about is residents now are having to really, really focus on either caring for COVID or their educational program has been so disrupted by institutional or facility changes where they're receiving their training. And how that's going to factor into their readiness when they complete residency, or for the medical students as they enter residency. But it was also interesting, just the other day, I was talking to a colleague, and he mentioned that some of the residents were hesitant to go to the hospital and attend rounds, and they were objecting to being around COVID-19 patients, which was really remarkable for me to hear. I commented that that's not something that would have even entered my mind and my thought process when I was a medical student and a resident, considering what my obligations are as a physician. And, you know, part of that obligation is to see as many patients and as learn as much as possible when I was in training so that I would be able to help my patients, when I was in private practice. So there are definitely some differences. Yeah.
I mean, I was talking to a colleague, a friend, about being a surgeon, and, you know, if I was afraid to go into the OR because I might catch something or because I'm going to make an incision and I'm thinking about all the bad stuff that could happen, there's a degree of fearlessness that you and faith that you have to be a physician, and our patients depend on that.
Right.
You know, so I hope that mindset goes away, but that, there you go. I think that's part of this indoctrination of fear. No matter what you do, you can't protect yourself, and you're going to pass away from, it's just that overwhelming, I think in some instances, not really attached to the medical reality of what's going on. It seems to be more of a social thing as well. And I think that's dangerous, frankly, because we need at some point to, we can't live this way indefinitely. I just don't think it's healthy.
Correct. As human beings, when we face uncertainty or fear or anxiety, you know, we're liable to respond in maybe three dysfunctional ways. We can deny that there's a problem, that anything's going on, and so we cut ourselves off from the ability to solve a problem and recruit resources and engage our own internal resilience. We may avoid, so just not participate. I'm not going to go to the grocery store. I'm not going to go to church and, you know, have that fulfilling experience. I'm not going to go back to work because I'm afraid of catching COVID-19. And then, you know, if that happens, then life just becomes so constricted that we really can't live out our potential and our purpose. The third thing that we tend to do when faced with uncertainty or fear is attack. So we might begin to blame other people. We get grumpy and irritable. So we may display some of that in our family members, the people that love us most, or colleagues, or on a broader scale, you know, attack society and traditional institutions and things like that. So I think that outlet, that third option of attack when confronted with uncertainty of fear and fear, is maybe some of what's going on. It's been pent up. People were locked down, and now you know, we're trying to work through that phase of it, and hopefully we'll get to a point where that runs its course, and then we can kind of let reason and more healthy, more functional adaptive mechanisms take over.
I certainly hope so. One of the things that strikes me is the inability to listen and have empathy for the other side. There seems to be this moral inequivalence. I'm not sure if you want to, it's not equal. So somebody's the moral high ground, and everybody else is just the worst person in the world. And so you're justified in attacking and physically demeaning, mentally degrading, or whatever you're choosing to do to take the upper hand. And that is, I've never felt that in society before. Is this a new phenomenon, or is this what you said, an outgrowth of just being put upon for months?
Yeah, well, I don't think it's new. I think it's been simmering for quite some time. I mean, you know, you look at literature. So first we had the closing of the American mind, and now we have the coddling of the American mind, and we went from the age of enlightenment to the age of entitlement. So I think this is really the manifestation of a process that's been going on for some time. You know, we used to talk about things like moral relativity, mm-hmm. and I think that's an outdated concept now. I think that what we're seeing is an alternative morality, because you can be a heretic, you can be canceled, you can be shamed for having a contrary idea. You know, you're either in the in group or the out group, and if you don't toe the party line, then there's going to be social consequences. And we've, you know, there are people who've started to equate ideas with violence and respond mm-hmm. accordingly. So that's really unprecedented in our culture. And it's something that we're really going to have to wrestle with and be smart about. And it, you know, it goes back to being able to reason, but also have that emotional intelligence to be able to listen empathetically and take on other people's perspectives. And I think that that's something that was always inculcated, whether through family or in the schools and how things were structured in our society and culture. I think that a lot of us in our generation and the generations before us, that was built into society. And it seems that somewhere along the way, we've lost that. That's no longer what happens in schools and universities.
No, they seem to be more of an indoctrination, and anything that ties us together has been defined as being racist, sexist, something very negative. And so you can't even call yourself really an American, because those on the side of the left, if you want to put it that way, or the progressives, whatever the label they want to put themselves under, it's antithesis of what they believe in. It's not about freedom of choice or freedom of association or freedom of speech. It's about you shut up and do it our way. Otherwise, we'll, like you said, cancel you or physically attack you or remove your livelihood. At some point, I would think that we have to get into a position where we have to have a standard of what the country stands for. You know, freedom to pursue what your God-given right is. It's coming from God. It's not coming from man, right? Your natural rights are things that everybody has. No one has more than anybody else on that one. So if we can hopefully move back towards that and away from this subjective, artificial, somebody's better than somebody else. And it's really sad because it's based now on color of skin and not content of character.
Yeah. And I think we have an opportunity to do that. But it's, you know, if there is a large enough group of people that really wants to tear away the fabric of Western civilization and its roots in, you know, revelation in Jerusalem and reason in Athens, then we're going to continue to have a lot of conflict and a lot of problems, because it's that framework that allows people to disagree, but get along and live together mm-hmm. and all pull together and get through times like these.
Agree to disagree. And there's nothing wrong with that. And conversation and sharing of ideas, even if they're opposed to each other. I mean, we're both students, you know. I think doctors are always students for the rest of our careers.
Right.
And it's about learning. You can't keep doing the same thing in a little hole and expect to expand. And I'm hoping that I hope and pray that you're right, that this stops, because it's just so toxic. I think people are kind of at their wit's end and just done with it. On that note, let's take our last break. You're living in the solution.
This is Dr. George. Living in the solution is not only about taking control of your health, it's about peace of mind. In uncertain times, your financial health is also important because it gives you options. I took control of my financial health by contacting Miles Franklin Investments, a company with 30 years of experience, an A+ Better Business Bureau rating, and over $600 billion in investments. They're also only one of 24 companies approved by the U.S. Mint. I recommend you find out if investing in gold or silver is right for your future. Contact Andy at milesfranklin.com and put Dr. George in the subject line for the best price, guaranteed. Understanding health insurance is becoming more challenging. If you currently have insurance, you've probably noticed that it costs more to see your doctor. And if you're able to keep your doctor, it takes longer to get an appointment. The bad news is this trend is projected to continue. Your costs will continue to rise while your healthcare choice and access will fall. The good news is Peachtree ENT Center has the answer to this problem. We're committed to working with you. We specialize in providing affordable care for patients without insurance, those who are underinsured, and those with high deductible or catastrophic coverage. And we offer same-day appointments. You no longer have to choose between staying healthy and paying bills because Peachtree ENT Center is where patient care counts. Call 404-591-9100 or visit us at peachtreeentcenter.com.
Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Guthrie. Again, he's a member of the Christian Medical Association and the American Academy of Psychiatry and the Law, and he's a practicing physician, a teacher, and somebody who is a thought leader, someone who's thinking about where we need to go without emotion. And that's my second question. When people live in fear as their base, does that negate their ability to think critically and to reason?
Certainly. So when we get scared or we get angry, we lose IQ points. And so that really detracts from our ability to, just even in a neurobiological sense. So we develop tunnel vision when we're stressed and we're not able to see the corners of the room and take in more information to inform our thought process and our moods and behaviors. So that's definitely a problem. And that definitely is a phenomenon that happens, that we, when we're angry or we're scared, we short circuit those higher reasoning abilities and really rob ourselves of the ability to solve problems.
With that in mind, is there something that you would recommend that people can do to kind of center themselves, to get themselves out of that emotional brain and move back towards something that's stable?
Sure. Yeah, part of it is just good self-care. So I think, this is probably a good opportunity to talk about some of the things that people can do to manage their stress during this time. One thing is maintaining relationships. So staying connected, communicating. Things like getting enough sleep, regular exercise, eating well on a schedule, just maintaining a routine. So once those basics are taken care of, then people can start to deal with more information, what's happening kind of beyond their own nose, outside their own homes, and begin to source information in a wise and responsible way, typically not from social media. And that way they can develop some of these skills where they can support and enhance mindfulness and coping skills and the ability to accept things as they are, not necessarily to like them or to completely agree with them. But without that acceptance, then pain turns into suffering. And so being able to just accept things as they are, being gentle enough and forgiving with oneself and with other people, I think that starts the process of some healthy things to do to manage stress and keep that fear and anxiety from becoming overwhelming.
Let me ask a secondary question, because we're dealing with a lot of anger, a lot of emotional pain when we see people on the screen just having moments and episodes. For those folks, and I think the majority of the country is not in that emotional destitution, frankly, but they're not able to speak up and they don't feel comfortable in sharing their views because they're afraid they're going to get hurt, whether that's economically or physically. What do you say to the people who are the silent majority, who are not happy with the destruction, with being told that they're the worst people on earth when they're not, and just because of what they may look like, that they're evil? How do you have those people speak up, take their power back, and stop being inundated, at least emotionally, with this mindset?
Well, I think that not being inundated aspect of it is important. A lot of it comes from our exposure to media. Because in our culture, media, whether it's TV news or social media, Facebook, Twitter, it's really geared to elicit a strong emotional response, to keep, you know, eyes on the screen, to click through to the next story or next feed. So really limiting that, because I think the more we're exposed to extreme examples, number one, we begin to think that that's the norm, that maybe that's happening far more than it really is. And it colors our perceptions of the people that we, you know, see in our own communities, and it begins to affect how we interact with other people. So really, really being wise in how we choose to, you know, what we take in, and what in places, sources of information that we use. So I think that's the first step to doing that. The next step would be, you know, looking for ways to recognize and amplify kindness and generosity. So opportunities to display goodwill to our neighbors, to the people we may interact with at work or the grocery store. And just paying attention for those opportunities where we could help other people and engage in some meaningful action in a positive way, and really model the behavior that we would like to see in our homes and our communities.
That's a really good point. I mean, there's nothing like giving back. There's something very satisfying, and on a deep level, it just makes you feel good,
sure,
quite frankly.
Sure.
And we have to find some way to actively be kind. I think you made a really good point. Instead of talking about it, is that, you know, that statement of you need to be the change and mm-hmm. not expect it to come from outside. And I think if everybody did one, sounds cliche maybe, but one kind thing a day, that would make a huge difference.
Absolutely. And just, you know, being able to keep track, to keep even a short list of the positive things that are going on in our lives, keeping that handy for when we start to get discouraged, when we start to get scared about what's going on, and just reflect on that. Give ourselves a moment to do that and have that ready in order to keep our perspective where we want it to be.
I think my second corollary to that is, if you really are centered and you know you're giving, you're a good person, you're doing things that are positive, doesn't that blunt? Let's say you can't always avoid some folks, right? You might come into contact with them in the supermarket or whatever.
Right.
Wouldn't that be a way to have more of a barrier, a wall against that kind of negative energy that, from an emotional standpoint, if you're fragile, you only need one thing sometimes to tip you over and for you to internalize it. But if you're doing this constantly, it's almost like working a muscle, isn't it? The more you exercise it, the more immune you get to this negative force, negative energy coming at you, and you're able to just ride it out.
Absolutely. That's how we mitigate stress. You know, we need a little stress. We need that eustress in our lives, but we don't need distress. And so what keeps us from being distressed is having that fortitude, developing it over time through challenges, through working through problems, doing something that's difficult or even hard, whether that's professionally or in a hobby or a sport, something like that, engaging with other people, you know, talking about ideas that differ and having those conversations and being able to think through things. And so you develop that fortitude and resilience. So you have that internal resilience that is really protective for when things get hard, when there's a difficult situation, whether an interpersonal situation or something at home or a global pandemic. If you have that confidence, if you've developed that resilience over time, then you're going to be better able to weather that storm. And I think that's one of the reasons that churches are so important, because, you know, in our faith, that's built in. We have a community, we have fellowship, we have hope, we have the ability to, you know, be supported by other people and support others in turn. And that's all built in. And, you know, even though we're praying to God, and, you know, some people might think that we might be giving up that locus of control. The research actually shows that people who do that, who engage in their faith and practice their faith, actually have a greater sense of confidence and internal control when faced with difficult situations.
I think it not only from a spiritual standpoint, but also energetically. I'm not sure if you've ever seen, I don't know if it's a Japanese researcher or from perhaps it's Sweden, I'm not sure, but they use water as the template. And people either put in, you know, speak negative things, curse words, etc. And you see this disorder in the structure of the water. And then they show someone praying and it looks beautiful, just crystalline like a snowflake, totally ordered. So your mind, what you say, how you say it, all of those things, actually you speak into existence something that's positive and ordered and beautiful versus the exact opposite. It's really neat to watch. So from a standpoint of people being able to access, I think you mentioned that there were apps and there were programs that people could go to, but if you can just reiterate what those are, organizations that people can reach out to so that they can, you know, speak with somebody and center themselves.
Sure. Some of the primary telehealth options for psychiatry or psychological counseling include American Well, Teladoc, and Insight. There's also some apps that people may want to use that some have more evidence-based than others when it comes to helping depression and anxiety. One is Sanvelo, formerly known as Pacifica. Headspace is actually one that's seeking FDA approval. Mood Path and My Strength are two other tools that we use sometimes. Folks may want to check out the Psychological First Aid mobile app. It's very educational, very helpful, and really timely when it comes to helping those around us and even taking good care of ourselves in times of disaster or pandemic. And some of the places that, you know, just good sources of information for taking care of mental health in this time of crisis. So some of the government-sponsored websites, so SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, they have some good resources for folks to use. The Mental Health America is one for general public, for practitioners, and obviously NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and then the Christian Medical and Dental Association has some good resources and some good opportunities to support people in healthcare. So the doctors and nurses and therapists who are on the front lines and want to engage with and have that support and have that fellowship with other like-minded healthcare professionals.
Thank you. I mean, the time goes so quickly. I really want to thank you for spending time with me today and our audience. I think I learned a lot, and I'm sure my audience did as well. And it's powerful and it's hopeful because we have so many tools that we can use, and you're right, just need to disconnect from the negativity that's being showered on us so that we can get our bearings, get our center, and in my opinion, take our power back. And do you write a blog or do you have anything that people can follow you?
Nothing right now. I stay busy taking care of folks where I am in about 17 states across the nation. That keeps me pretty busy.
I'd say it does. Well, once again, thank you so much for joining me. It was an absolute pleasure to speak with you.
I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.